in every region of the country. And so that's how come Sunrise, BAR, Savannah, and all of them were set up. And so I'm absolute faith in the GBC network.
I see. Thank you, and you're welcome aboard. Accounting to the people, Your Excellency, your impression so far?
My impression is very good. We arrived here 2 days ago. Today is the third day of the tour. Previously, we had been in Western Region, and then in Eastern Region, and then in Water Region, and then we came to Bongahafu Region 2 days ago. So I've been here for 3 days. This is the third day. And it has taken us through Dema, where we commissioned one of the community senior high schools. And then we came to Techimentia and had one of the polyclinics, new polyclinics that we have built in Techimentia. And then from there we came to Dadeswaba, where we're doing a lot of road projects, GWD to Dadeswaba and several of the other roads projects that we're doing there. Yesterday we started in Sunyani and we inspected two important roads, I was amazed that we've left these roads for so many years. The Inner Ring Road in 1998, President Rawlings did half of it. Mm. And the other half was left since then till now. And it's only now that we're working on the other half to complete the Inner Ring Road. After the other Outer Ring Road, the road reservation was left. It's been lying, fallow, but nobody had started to work on it. Today we're working on the Outer Ring Road. It's 33 kilometers. And once we finish that, it will mean that you can go from one point in Sunyani from the Kumasi Road and go completely around the city and come back to the same point. Sunyani is a very well-planned city.
Okay.
And the way the roads have been laid out, especially with the two rings around the city, it makes traffic flow, when we finish those roads, it will make it very, very easy. Aside from that, we're doing 25 kilometers of asphalt overlay on the roads of Sunyani to improve the riding surface and then also to make the roads last much longer. And so those are the kinds of works that we're doing here in Sunyani. It will give Sunyani a very big uplift, facelift in terms of the beauty of the city. And so we're doing that. Then we continue to Nkwanza. Yeah, my in-laws. I want to say hello to my in-laws and to renew my homage to them. We had a very good meeting. We've done a lot of work in the technical school there and then the secondary school. We built dormitory blocks, administration blocks, dining halls, and so many things. I was supposed to commission about 11 projects there, but we did only one because time was running out for us. And then we ended up yesterday, 19, Abiyase.
Okay.
Abiyase yesterday had the honor of switching on lights for them for the first time. Switching on their lights for the first time. This is the first time they are getting lights since we started the rural electrification program. So, of course, it was a very happy day for them. Aside from that, we are doing the road from Prang through Abiyase to Kintampo, which is also an old traditional road that has been in a very poor condition for a long time. And Abiyase area, they grow a lot of yams, maize, and other things. And so that road, opening up that road is very good because then they can come through Kintampo to Techima. There's another road that comes from Nkwanza to Abiyase. We want to work on that road after we finish this one so that they can have alternatives, either to go to Kintampo and to Tamale or through Nkwanza to Techima. And so that also, we also stopped in Techima and we commissioned them a new classroom block for the Techiman Secondary School, and then also paid them a visit to the Techiman Mini. And so far, it's been a very good visit. It's a working tour, and as president, you don't only sit in the staff house and receive reports about what's happening. From time to time, you must go into the field and see, for yourself how projects are going and programs are going. And so, since I became president, I've done that so many times. I've been to the Water Region about 16 times. I've been to Bongahafu Region about 14 times. So, it's not strange, for the president to come out, on a working visit. And so, this is a working visit, but we've dubbed it accounting to the people. Because the fourth pillar of our manifesto, our manifesto is based on four pillars. The fourth pillar is transparent and accountable governance. And under accountable governance, you need to tell the people what you're doing for them. And
so, remember, one of our evil lieutenants, Dr. Manubwana, had to come to your aid that no, this is not a campaign move that you are doing. But the question I was going to ask, the way you are commissioning progress here and there, when you really start your campaign, I don't know what you are going to commission. Perhaps you might have finished commission everything in this country on the ticket of accounting to the people. Are you an abusing officer, as your competitors are saying?
The issue of incumbency has been discussed over the years. This is not the first time we're talking about it. Incumbency comes with advantages and disadvantages.
It's an advantage.
Well, if you call it an advantage, the fact is, the president is the head of states, and the state is responsible for the president's security and transport. So anywhere I go, even in the campaign period, the state would have to transport me in safety. And so commissioning projects is something a president does. Projects become ready at a certain time. I won't say because an election is due, then you suspend commissioning all projects that are ready and wait till after elections before you commission them. It doesn't make any sense. As I speak, there are projects that are going on. There are projects that will be ready for commissioning in September, in October, in November, even in December, even in January.
So
we can begin to use it.
You are accused of being saying somewhere along the line that wrote for me.
So all of us decide and say that yes, we shall set these rules of incumbency, and we'll also set a political season and say maybe 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, campaign is lifted, everybody goes into campaign mode. So it's a debate we are willing to participate in as a party, yeah.
Precious one, in case you've tuned in, is Radio BR of the Ghana Broadcasting Corporation, and we're playing host to His Excellency the President of this Republic, His Excellency John Dramani Mahama. Mr. President, the Better Ghana Agenda, let's take a look at education. Let me start from basic education. I have read severally that you stated that come 2020, schools and the trees will be a thing of the past. With or without you, is that dream achievable?
Yeah, the dream is achievable.
With or without you?
With or without me. I think that if any government prioritizes it, we should be able to completely eliminate schools and the trees. That is those that we have surveyed and counted. I remember that in 2010, when we did a survey, it was said that there were 4,200 schools under trees. Since then, we've kept taking them out, and I must say we've taken out more than 1,700 schools under trees. And I believe that over the next 5 years, up to 2020, if we continue at the rate at which we're going, we should be able to take out all the 4,200 schools under trees. Because one of the things we've done is, apart from central government investing in removing these schools, we also have required the District Assembly's Common Fund to enjoin every district assembly to build two schools every year. And so they must take out two schools under trees every year.
Okay.
So where there are no proper schools or proper structures, the district assembly every year must build two schools. Now we have 216 district assemblies. So if each of them is building two schools a year, that already is 432 schools every year. And so if by the survey that we have, we still have about 2,000 and a little over 2,000 schools under trees, then building 432 schools, even at the district assembly level alone, would almost have taken them out. Not to talk about central government's commitment. Get Fund is also taking out schools under trees, and then central government is also budgeting for it. So I believe that, notwithstanding any administration that is on, if they continue the policy that we have started, by 2020, the 4,200 schools that we surveyed would have been taken up. But let me remind you, human settlement continues to occur. So as you are taking out this 4,200, new settlements are coming up. You understand? And children are being born in that settlement who would need a school. So I'm not saying that after we take out these 4,200, there won't be another 200 or 300 that have suddenly, you know, cropped up. And so it's a process that we have to continue, no matter what government is in power.
Okay. Let me get to the second cycle. We saw Kind Kelsey, GTV, the very beautiful school that you commissioned in Dema. But you are quoted to have said that you want to get 150,000 bodies who are from deprived homes in boarding schools get free secondary education. The million-dollar question is, how do you really determine who is really poor? Because as I sit here, whether I'm poor or not, I would have loved my son or daughter to be part of this. So when you say the deprived, it raises question.
The Ministry of Education will set the criteria, and they are doing that to identify the students who would qualify. It's something we'll continue to expand. And so we say, look, if we're starting with borders, let's start with deprived schools and students from deprived families. And so that criteria will be established, and the 150,000 will be selected. Already we're doing that. For instance, the World Bank has given us scholarships for 10,000 deprived students. How are we going to choose the 10,000 deprived students?
That is my problem.
There's a criteria that the Ministry of Education is establishing.
Well, who will not lick Annie if it is to drop from above?
Anthony,
definitely.
Anthony, first you start with the most deprived districts. You can start with the most deprived districts.
No, okay.
And we have statistics that show the most deprived districts. And so you can start with the most deprived districts, start with the most deprived schools.
I see.
You understand? And you will find the most deprived students.
Okay.
But we'll continue to expand it.
Okay.
You know, so it will eventually.
Mr. President, from secondary, let me get to the tertiary. Sunyani Polytechnic will pretty soon become a technical university. And I read somewhere on the net, you said it is not just by name, by an agenda. What did you mean by that, sir, with due respect?
What I meant is that we are not just changing the name of the institution, but the institution is going to become a new institution. It's not going to continue to be what it is. It means that the quality of education has to rise to become, you know, the level of a university. Mm-hmm. And then we have to improve the faculty. We have to improve the infrastructure to justify it being a university. And so it's not going to be just a change of name. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a change of curricula. It's going to be a change of quality. And that's why we're upgrading the workshops. If you notice, in all the polytechnics I went, I opened new laboratories and workshops for them. Because we're bringing it up to the standard where it can be a world-class technical university. And so all the universities and the polytechnics that have qualified, we're doing a lot of work, especially in the engineering blocks, in the technical workshops, and so on and so forth. And so that is going very well.
So are we looking at a situation where we will not have paper engineers and paper technicians in this country?
Well, our intention is that these should be well-trained, practical, skills-oriented graduates who are coming out, because our interaction with industry shows that that is the kind of graduate they want. Industry does not want to go and take fresh graduates and then go and train them themselves. You know that labor is very mobile. And so after you've trained somebody on the shop floor for 5 years, somebody offers him a higher salary, and then he leaves you and goes and works with a person.
Man must survive.
Exactly. And so they want part of that training to be done by government, so that by the time they take the person, he's got skills to a certain level, so that the amount that they invest in bringing him up to the level they want is not as much. And so even if they lose him, you know, then it doesn't really make a difference. And so in many of these technical universities, they go to school for 2 years, do a lot of the theory, and then they leave school for 1 year and do a one whole year internship working on the shop floor, either as a welder or as something. They do work on the shop floor and they go to the different departments. Then they come back to school to come and complete. And so when they come out, they are skilled and, you know, ready for the world of work. And so we want these to continue to be practical, skills-oriented universities. And aside from that, we want the kinds of graduates that come out, you know, to be easily employable and be able to go into the world of work. Also, we want them to remain faithful to their core training obligation of technical and vocational.
Okay.
We don't want them to metamorphose into business universities and then start business administration and all those other courses. We want them to ensure that science-based and technical and vocational courses from at least above 70%, 80% of the admissions that they make.
According to the people still on it, let's take a look at health. And I have seen some polyclinics that have been built. Actually, I can make mention of the one few one, but I did not get opportunity of getting inside there. Say, are they well equipped? And by way of personnel, do we have the right professionals and professionals in there for the sake of the people?
Let me just top up what I was saying. Business administration, all those courses are important.
Okay.
Yeah, but there are many universities offering it already.
Okay.
And so we don't want the technical universities to follow in their steps and add more space for those courses, because there are enough spaces for those courses already. I just don't want to be misinterpreted by anybody.
No, okay.
But with regards to healthcare, the polyclinics, and this is going to be about the sixth or seventh one I've visited. Those polyclinics are beautiful. I mean, I wouldn't call them polyclinics, I call them mini hospitals.
Okay.
Because everything a hospital has, they have. They have a surgery, a theater for doing simple operations, hernias, caesarean sections, and all that. They have a delivery room, they have a maternity ward, they have a male ward, they have a children's ward. They have a little laundry. They have a treatment room. They have just name anything that a hospital has. They have it in miniature, and so every equipment they need to, like a hospital, they have. And so the polyclinics are giving very good care. When I went to Techimentia to their polyclinic, the good news, and I want to commend all the health personnel in Techimentia, you know, in that district, for the good work that not Techimentia town, but the district.
This is my breakfast radio station in Brongahafu, 93.5 station BAR.
I want to encourage and commend all the health workers in that district, you know, and because for last year they had only one maternal death. And even though the statistics are good, we want zero maternal deaths. That is what we should all aim for. But unfortunately, they lost one mother. But I think they've done very well, and so they need to be commended. There are a few other districts that here had zero maternal deaths. And so if that is the case, then it means we're making progress towards eliminating maternal mortality. We, in 2000, you know, lost 900 mothers for every 100,000 live births in 2000. Today, we are losing about 300 mothers for every 100,000 live births. That means we've cut maternal deaths by two-thirds. And so it means that there's something positive happening in our healthcare. But of course, the best statistic is to have zero maternal deaths, because if your mother or your wife is one of the 300, it's unacceptable. And so we need to continue to work hard at achieving that.
I see. Precious one, we are with the President of this Republic, His Excellency John Dramani Mahama, right here in the studios of Radio BAR, Sunyani, the capital of the Brongahafu region. Mr. President, unposted and unpaid nurses. Yesterday on TV, I saw them demonstrating, heading towards the Flagstaff House, but the police said, no way. In all, we are told that that group alone, by way of numbers, are 2,241. So, what is happening?
We are in the process of recruiting bonded nurses, that is, nurses who have come out of the public training institutions. And so that process is ongoing. Even by virtue of building more health facilities, we're creating more space to absorb them. And so when I go around inspecting these health facilities and pushing the ministry to complete them quickly, it's to create more space for us to take on nurses. As we build new CHIPS compounds, it creates more space for us to take on nurses. And so every year, financial clearance is given for the number of nurses based on a survey of what the need is. And so every year we take in those nurses. But I've asked that we give priority to the nurses who are trained in public institutions.
every nurse wants to work in public institutions because the remuneration is much better. And so nobody wants to go to the private sector. You know, some of the nurses that are being trained by the private institutions, their intention was that the private sector would also absorb them.
Okay.
But because the salaries and conditions in the public sector are much better than in the private sector, everybody wants to be recruited by government, both bonded and non-bonded nurses. And so that is the situation we're facing currently. But we're expanding the health sector as quickly as we can. And as we expand the health sector, we'll continue to absorb more nurses. Note that we have a net freeze on the civil service and the local government service. But we don't have a freeze on the health sector and education sector. We're taking teachers, we're hiring nurses as they come out of school. And so it's something that we are continuing to work on. I'll ask the Ministry of Health to speed up the process of that recruitment so that we can get the nurses. They've been coming, they've been picketing my office from time to time. They come and stand on the Flagstaff House Junction so that when I'm going to work, I notice that they are still there. But that group that came and stood outside the Flagstaff House, we virtually recruited almost all of them. So this is a new group, a new batch. Every year we're taking out more of them. And so we need to expand the healthcare sector as quickly as possible so that we can absorb as many of them as possible.
You talked of the restoration of the nurses' allowance. How are you going to do that? Because earlier on there was a counter and the teachers were also calling for this, and the argument was that that has been turned into a tertiary institution for them, that they should go in for loans. But I've heard you saying that you'll restore that of the nurses. Won't that bring some sort of banter between the two professionals?
We have
and
a
your government.
We have a dichotomy there. What happens is the nursing training institutions are under the Ministry of Health, and the teacher training institutions are under the Ministry of Education. Mm-hmm. Now, all tertiary institutions under the Ministry of Education are entitled to student loans. Mm-hmm. You understand? We upgraded the colleges of education to degree awarding tertiary institutions. They have their colleagues in University of Education Winneba, and they have their colleagues in University of Cape Coast who are also doing the same training to come out as professional teachers. They don't get any allowance. And so you had a discriminatory situation where, depending on where you went for your training, professional training as a teacher, you could earn trainee allowances. Or if you went to the established universities, University of Education Winneba or Cape Coast, then you didn't earn trainee allowances. And so once we decided that we're making them tertiary institutions and bringing them at par with their colleagues in the other universities, then you needed fairness across board. But the most important thing is 60% of them would not be in the colleges of education if we were still paying to teacher trainee allowances. Because there was a quota system. The benefit in swapping teacher trainee allowances with student loans is that it allows us to abolish the quota system and make more people come into the College of Education to be able to get a training as a teacher and get a job. And so 60% of those who are currently in colleges of education won't be there if we're paying trainee allowances. And so that's the simple truth about it. And the point is, if you take the numbers we have in the teacher training colleges today, because we have increased the numbers by 63%, actually, there are 63% more people training to be teachers than we were doing during the teacher training allowances. Now, if you take the increased numbers and you calculate how much we need annually to pay teacher trainees, it amounts to 223 million Ghana cedis. 223 million Ghana cedis. And so that is the crunch. And so we're saying that we have not scrapped teacher trainee allowances. What we've done is, like happens in the established tertiary institutions, we have swapped teacher trainee allowances with student loans, like every student in tertiary education is entitled to have.
But the students are saying they don't like that. They prefer the allowance to the loan. So why don't you make a special thing for them? Because they still wear uniforms. It was recently that I heard that.
We've cancelled uniforms. They used to go out with exeats like they were still in secondary school. We've cancelled that. These are educational universities. You understand? You can't eat your cake and have it. These are educational universities.
So, Mr. President, it means you cannot restore the allowances to the teachers.
The teachers, we have swapped it. I said, we have not scrapped it. We have swapped it with a student loan, like all their colleagues in other universities.
They tell you that the value is not the same.
Yeah, because, as, of course, who doesn't want to earn 500 CDs a month? No, because they're being paid 500 CDs a month.
Which is all 5 million.
Yes. Mm. And so if you calculated the number, the numbers, then we're going to have to restrict the numbers that went in. And so the teacher training allowances came with a quota system. And so most of the colleges of education employed admitted only 40% of their capacity. And so even though there was more space to admit more students, because of the cost of the trainee allowances alone, government could not admit more students. So we said that with their upgrade into tertiary institutions as universities, then we must bring equity across board and be able to bring in more students. And so we've increased admission into colleges of education by 63%. And so those 63% extra who are in the colleges would not have had the opportunity to be there if we did not swap the trainee allowances and the student loan. So what I've said to the student loan scheme is that they should go to the colleges of education and physically register them. We have relaxed the rules for the loan. You can have only one guarantor, and that's sufficient. Formally, you have to have two guarantors. And we have a lot of the conditions that the student loan required, we have relaxed them, especially for colleges of education, so that a lot more of them can register and access the student loan.
I see. We'll have to move on because I have a lot to ask you, Mr. President.
Yes.
I'm standing in for the whole Bravo and beyond.
That's right.
Yes.
I hear all your other stations.
Yes, we are live all over. And even private stations have hooked on.
I want to say hello to all the people listening to us this morning.
Still on health, because I'm told health is the most, it's paramount, it's the greatest. If you have life, you have everything.
Yeah.
Yes, health insurance in IRS. The last checks that I did revealed that they are in arrears of 9 months, 10 months. The monies are not in, and that has affected service delivery in one way or the other. Quite apart from that, cash and carry is surfacing in disguise, and it's also affecting drugs for patients. Sir, what is happening?
That's why I've set up a committee to restructure the health insurance. When it was started, an actuarial study was done that showed that if we do not find new sources of income for the national health insurance, it would collapse at a certain date. I think 2009 or something. I don't remember the year, but that was the actuarial study that was done. Since then, we have not found new sources of financing, but the health insurance is still laboring on. Government is up to date with its payments. So it's not the fault of government. You can ask the National Health Insurance.
They told me government hasn't paid. The last time they had
was in
July 2015.
No, government is up to date with its payments. Actually, government is supposed to owe the health insurance one quarter. Because
That is a 90-day period.
Yeah, you need to calculate how much is due to them. And so you need a quarter to be able to calculate what is due to them before you pay. But now, every month, government is releasing estimated what is due to health insurance. Then at the end of the quarter, they calculate to see if there's a shortfall or there's an overpayment. And if there's an overpayment, it's deducted from the next quarter. And so government is up to date. It is the structure of the health insurance itself. We need to restructure it. And that is why I've set up, you know, a committee to look at restructuring the health insurance. Let me give you a few statistics.
Okay.
In 2005, total outpatient utilization of the health insurance, total outpatient utilization, it means the number of times people come to the outpatient department demanding service, was 500 and almost 600,000, 597,000 outpatient utilization. In 2014, outpatient utilization rose to 29.6 million visits, from 597,000 visits to 29.6 million visits in 2014. You can see the phenomenal increase in utilization.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that, claims payments in 2005, the whole of 2005, amounted to less than 8 million Ghana cedis. If you want to be precise, about 7.6 million Ghana cedis for the whole of 2005. Now, in 2014, the whole of 2014, claims payments amounted to 1.07 billion cedis, from 7.6 million cedis to 1.07 billion cedis. So it should show you the magnitude of the expansion that this health scheme has undergone in a short period. So what we're doing is we've put in a committee to restructure it so that, one, we can increase efficiency, two, we can eliminate fraud. I've asked them to fast-track their computerization so that we take away as much human discretion as possible so that we can cut down fraud. Three, to expand the capitation system to the whole of the country. They have done the pilot. The pilot has been successful. And so if we expand the capitation, it will help to reduce, you know, the amount of money that is going out. It will make it more efficient. It will be easy to audit and make sure that the claims are correct. And so that committee is undertaking the restructuring. As I speak, the computerization program is being fast-tracked. They are expanding clinical audits of claims and so on and so forth. And so we would be able to make this health insurance more efficient to be able to serve people. But it is the rate at which it has grown. It has grown phenomenally over the period, and it is providing service to a lot of people. I've also told them to avoid excessive capital expenditure, so they should postpone, you know, capital expenditure and put more money into settling fraud claims. Into settling claims, you know. But the net effect of that, that is the NHIS, is that Ghana, when you take the Human Development Index in terms of healthcare, has made quite significant advances. If you take the UN Human Development Index, we are second only to Cape Verde in terms of access to healthcare, in terms of rate of reduction of maternal mortality, in terms of rate of reduction of child mortality, in terms of rate of infant mortality under 5 deaths and all that. So the National Health Insurance has made a very, very positive impact on our health delivery. And I'm going to make sure as president that that scheme does not collapse under my presidency. It's not collapsing. It's giving more service than it has ever done before. And when we do the restructuring that we're doing, it will make it even more efficient than it has ever been in its history.
I hope and pray that it will be fast-tracked so that people are complaining too much and that there's a belief that when you go with money, that one, you are giving special treatment. But if it's the cash and if it is the card type, the going with the health insurance card, it becomes a different ballgame. So we hope and pray that what you've said, you've put in place, is fast track so that we don't get people dying here and there because of administrative bureaucracies. You touched on rules in your opening this, and so I don't want us to belabor that point. But quickly, the people of Bafo are telling me to remind you that the Bekum Sekwa Road, they need the work they should hurry up by way of speeding up, I should say, with that work. And then the Sunyame Ring Road too, that they really want to see it in full shape or completed within the shortest possible time. In your opening remarks, you touched on roads, so I don't want us to backtrack and then get there.
The Bekum Sekwa Road, it was on GOG, that's Government of Ghana budget, and that's accounted for the slow pace. We've moved it onto the Cocoa Roads program. The Cocoa Roads program has a faster payment system.
Okay.
And so I'm sure that people will see the road going faster than it has done previously. The inner ring road, we have done all the culverts. We had to put in 5 major culverts. And then there were valleys that we had to fill. And so all that work has been done, and then the contractor has worked to the base level. So if you notice, he's put the gravel there, he's compacted it, and so he'll start the sealing, beginning to do the seal. Then after that, we'll do the asphalt overlay. And so we expect that by August, that is the estimate, that by August we should be able to open the inner ring road.
Is it the August of this year?
August of this year.
No, okay.
We expect that we should be able to open. I said that's the estimate, the engineer's estimate. We expect that the rate at which work is going, we expect that by August, end of August this year, we should be able to open the ring road to traffic. Already, if you pass on that road, you see a marked difference. You know, those who live along that road, when I was driving, driving on it yesterday and inspecting it, you could see they were very excited because for the first time, you know, they had the road open through and they could access their houses. So I'm sure by the time we finish it, late August, they would be very happy. We would also be able to finish half of the outer ring. We are doing the whole ring, but we expect that by the end of the year we should finish half of it. And so you can link up, you know, straight from the Techiman Road and come down to the Sunyani, to the Kumasi Road without coming through Sunyani Town. And so that also is on track.
Precious One, Radio BAR 93.5 Sunyani of the Ghana Broadcasting Corporation, and we are live on all our sister stations across the length and breadth of this country. We are playing host to the President of the Republic of Ghana, His Excellency John Dramani Mahama. Sir, when it comes to cashew, Brahavu is the leading producer. Last year, this region made 65,000 metric tons. And our people are calling for a board.
Yeah.
Like we have the cocoa board.
Yeah. I met the chief farmers and the chiefs from the cashew growing areas, I think, barely two weeks ago. They came to the Flagstaff House. They asked for an audience with me. And that was one of the main requests they put to government. We had a discussion and we all agreed that we will go forward with a cashew development board because we realized that cashew has a very big potential to become an export, a major export item, and to bring in foreign currency. Aside from that, it fits into my diversification plan. I announced in the State of the Nation address that we must not continue to rely only on cocoa. We must diversify and introduce other crops that would help, you know, our export drive. And so cashew is one of them. I also mentioned the oil palm as one of them. I mentioned the coffee as one of them. Ghana used to produce quite a lot of coffee before, but it dwindled because we over-concentrated on cocoa at the expense of coffee. So I mentioned coffee as one of them. I mentioned shrimp and aquaculture as another. And so it fits into that diversification drive. And so we'll do everything to support the cashew farmers. One of the first things we'll do is to set up a committee, an implementation committee, to work out the modalities for setting up the board. And once we get the report, then we will go ahead and set up the board, swear them in, and then we need to find offices for them to work. And I think that the capital of the board should be here in the Bronga Afu region, because the Bronga Afu is the biggest producer of cashew. So it's most likely that the cashew development board office is going to be here in the Bronga Afu region.
There is this question: if I don't ask you, the people of Bronga Afu will not be at ease with me at all. It is about microfinance.
Yeah.
The microfinance saga in this region, the hardest hit that one can think of. Mr. President, this is a region where you can find God is Love Fan Club. Here you can find Jester. You can find Little Drops. Perfect Edge. Sharp Sharp. Care for Humanity. And the greatest of all is DKM. So it tells you this is the headquarters of microfinance units in this country. And we are all aware of what happened. Recently, the Regional Coordinating Council led by the Regional Minister Honorable Erika Opoku succeeded in getting a temporal office for the liquidator where customers were made to submit their deposit receipts. And people still are not clear as to how things are going. But when the liquidator came out first, they had no office here, or the branches that were given, Brahavu was not included. But this is the hardest hit place. Say, this issue, how are you going to go about it, and can it really be solved? The focus is on DKM, but as I told you, Jester is there, Little Drops, Perfect Edge, Sharp Sharp, Care for Humanity, God is Love, and what have you.
There are several of these schemes that are glorified susu schemes. You know, we have our traditional susu where we all give money, and then after some time it's given to one person, and then when we contribute, then it's given to another person, then it comes round. Now, some of these susu schemes grew up into calling themselves, you know, mini microfinance schemes, but they are not microfinance schemes.
They call themselves fan club.
They are not licensed. They are not licensed by anybody to do the things they are doing. At the time that Bank of Ghana, you know, confronted some of them, they said they are fan clubs, they are voluntary clubs, and that they have come together to help themselves, like a Noboa kind of club.
Okay.
So let's put that aside. DKM was a licensed microfinance company. And so in that sense, Bank of Ghana's supervisory...
The day the ballot box is open, it's counted right there. All of us record the results so we know what happened at every station. We must have a party, our own means of coalition, our results, so that we're able to know what the results of the election is, even before the Electoral Commission has finished. We should in all those systems.
The side against corruption by your government, nothing. Many Ghanaians were happy when they did the reform. RLG has given back to the state. What do you mean? I still push and pull. Just a few days ago, I had a call saying that some two of his accounts should be closed. What kind of this corruption? How relevant is it? And how is it helping the situation? Because there is this fear that people are raking in money illegally and they are getting away.
In a lot of cases, we look at the end process of the act of corruption. We don't look at the beginning process and the systems that need to be put in place to prevent corruption from happening. One of the major things we need to continue to do is to take away as much human discretion as possible. And by that means you can reduce the incidence of corruption. But let's start with the end that you talked about. That is where corruption has occurred. This government is determined to expose and sanction it. And that is why we have all these cases. But like I said in the, one of my addresses, we cannot be admirers of constitutional democracy and be admirers of arbitrary justice. In the past, under unconstitutional government, it would have been easy for me as president to just go and pick up anybody who suspects of being corrupt and go and lock them up, and then take them to the tribunal process or through the judicial process. If they are found guilty, they continue serving their sentence. If they are found innocent, then we release them. You can't do that to them. You arrest them, you take a statement. Within 48 hours, you must present the person to court. You send him to court, his lawyer applies for bail, and he goes on bail. And until the case is finished, you cannot do anything about it. And so, it is the fear of justice that runs slowly. And how do you feel about that? Sometimes you feel frustrated, but like I said, once we are committed adherence of constitutional democracy, we must have patience for the process. And so I'm working just not on the end of exposing and sanctioning corruption, but also working on the end of putting in place systems that make it difficult for corruption to take place. And that's why I've been one of the major advocates of a cashless society. In Ghana, we carry too much cash. We use too much cash. Even countries that are in the same class as us, as lower middle income countries, they are using more electronic systems of payment than, you know, carrying cash around. And go to Kenya, people are using bank cards, using credit cards for settling transactions, or even using mobile money. Today in Ghana, mobile money is growing, which is a very good thing. And I'm saying that between now and 2020, we must do as much as possible to limit the amount of cash that Ghanaians use. We started that by limiting off the counter cashing of checks to 5,000 Ghana cedis. I remember there was an outcry when we did that, but we've all become used to it. If I give you a check of 10,000, you cannot go to the counter and cash 10,000 cedis. You have to go and pay it into your account. And so I'm happy that we're making progress. Mobile money is expanding. As we expand into a cashless society, it will help us in the fight against corruption. But aside from that, there are many things that we are doing in terms of legislation and other things to try and minimize corruption. We have the witness protection bill, which we are finalizing, so that if somebody gives a witness against a person who's been corrupt, we are able to protect them without them suffering any kind of consequences. We have the amendment to the whistleblower bill, which was sent into Parliament. We have the code of conduct for public officers bill, which was sent into Parliament. We set up the first citizen complaint center, and we've already started receiving complaints from the public and acting on it. We need to recruit more
about and investigate some of those complaints and all that. So we're working and continuing. If it's successful, we're going to open centers in all the 10 regions of Ghana. We also are introducing the business system for the budget so that removes discretion in terms of payment of the budget. I set up the sole commissioner's office for just on that. And the sole commissioner came up with a brilliant report. A white paper has been issued on it, and government is going to take steps to implement that white paper. But even before the sole commissioner finished his work, I had given the attorney general strict instructions to defend every case that was brought against government. And as a result of that tough stance defending government from judgment claims, we have saved this country more than $1 billion. You know, over the last 4 years, more than $1 billion. And it's all there in my accounting to the people book. Case by case, it's listed. And how the Attorney General's Department went out and defended it. So what we're doing is strengthening the Attorney General's Department. Also, we continue to invest in the judiciary so that we can speed up the system of justice. And we built the new court complex, and there are several courtrooms there. And so to help to speed up the system of justice.
On the plane host to the President of this Republic, Excellency John Dramani Mahama, we are now on all the DGP networks and participation data here on board. I think it's already out of here, and we attend to other matters. President, let's take a look at security. I have not drawn neighbors. La Côte d'Ivoire was in trouble recently. Burkina Faso was it. Mali was in trouble. Ghana, we are on alert, but we pray that nothing happens to us as a nation. But internally, we have groups like the Angola Boys, we have the Invisible Forces, we have the Bulldogs, and what have you. And with the latest edition of the African Watch, that's April 2016, Mr. Paul Afoko of the NPP has said three Serbians were in the system. And the Minister of Interior found it was done by the NPP, but Mr. Afoko is saying that it was 1-10-40 attack. We are recommending Chief of Ghana Armed Forces. Chief, I will say that our men and women are on top of issues in this country when it comes to security.
Security personnel are good, and they have protected us so far. And if you look at the statistics, as a result of several things we introduced, we see a reduction in the incidence of crime. We introduced disability policing, community policing. We procured new vehicles, you know, for the police. We enabled them to go around. We built more police stations. We've increased recruitment into the police service. And so if you look at the crime statistics from 20, comparing the previous year to 2014, I don't think they finalized the figures for 2015, but we saw a drop of 5,000 incidents compared to the prevailing year. And so it means that the reforms that we're introducing, the innovations we're introducing are working. And so it means we must continue to deepen those innovations. With regard to terrorism, it is a difficult thing for any country to deal with. As you can see what happened in France, what happened in Brussels, what happened in Cote d'Ivoire, what happened in Mali. These people are looking for soft targets. They mix the civilian population, and they'll either let out a bomb or they'll take out weapons and just start shooting innocent people. And so it's difficult to predict where that is going to happen. So you must just prepare to be able to respond. And then you must also now be cautious about who is coming in through your borders and being able to track, you know, who shares intelligence information. We started doing that in West Africa now. And so Cote d'Ivoire is providing us with information. Mali is providing us with information. We also, any information that we have of any suspicious person, we are sharing with our neighbors. And so that's a good thing. It didn't used to happen before. Our intelligence communities were not communicating with each other. Now they are doing that. And I think that it's a good thing. Aside from that, we're going to increase security at public places. We've done that already. And so people who are going into some of the top hotels, foreigners and others, will find that they are being checked. I appeal to Ghanaians to bear with us so that, you know, we do that to protect all of us. At the weekends when people go to the beach, they don't notice it, but we increase the security presence at the popular beaches. They like to go to places where there are a lot of foreigners. And so at the popular places where a lot of foreigners go, we don't let the public notice, but there are security forces close by that are waiting and watching if anything happens. We are increasing security at the shopping malls. At all the hotels, we've asked them to install scanners so that they're able to scan everybody coming in. You must put your bag to the scanner to see, you know, if there is something there that we need to. So we're tightening all that security. And we're also training special forces and all that. Now, with regard to the specific case you raised, as commander in chief, I receive a security briefing once every week. I get security bulletins every day, but I get a call security briefing once every week. Now, in one of the briefings a few years ago, in 2014, it came up that there were some Serbians who had been brought into the country to train people in civil insurrection. I remember that this particular work. And so the security agencies that they were tracking to see, you know, who these were, how they came in and all that. And so they checked in the immigration database and clearly they identified that those people had come in. So they kind of tracked where they were and all that. But it was a matter of some security concern in 2014. Somehow the Serbians left. And so they had placed them on the blacklist. One of the last reports said they had been placed on the blacklist. And an alert had been put out that any time they return to the country, they should be arrested, interrogated, and deported. So that was the last I heard about it. But then it came up in the Ministry of Interior statement when that training by the South African happened. And then just recently, I read the Africa Watch myself. This is the copy of the magazine. And I was shocked, you know, to learn that, yes, there was a confirmation that this is what has happened. We didn't know specifically who they were training, but from the interview Paul has given, he says that it was NCP activists from across the country who were brought to be trained. And so I think that the security services should ask a few more questions. It would be very helpful if Paul can help the security service with some more details about what exactly happened, you know, so that we're able to know what happened and to be able to prevent something like that from happening in the future.
Yeah, we are running out of time, and we will take our last one and then part two of the event. I know you have a lot to do for today, but let me do a quick talk this year. GDC. That are a digital political transition platform. Is there any hope?
Yeah. The work is very advanced, and I'm sure that it will be completed, you know, very soon. We've finished the Greater Accra region and Ashanti region, 100% complete. Greater Accra and Ashanti, and the other regions are being covered as possible. And so we hope that by September we should be completely compliant and be able to move on to a digital platform.
When there's just around the corner, you gave us cola as Daniel Wete. But you think the challenge of including all the cola. Daniel Wete has been any good news for us coming day?
I want to salute to all Daniel Wete and to thank them, you know, for the solidarity and the collaboration that we have enjoyed. It's not been an easy ride. I took this economy at a time when the deficit to GDP was 12%, and inflation was ballooning, interest rates were going up. It was necessary for us to bring some predictability into how wages, you know, were increased. Especially after we had finished the single fine and we had paid all the arrears. We realized that the bulk of the revenue we're collecting was all being consumed by wages and salaries. And it was making it difficult for the country to provide the other social and public services that were necessary. Over the years, we have collaborated with labor to be able to bring these things under control. Currently, see the deficit has come from almost 12% to 7.6%, and this year is going to go down to 5.3%. Inflation has started slowing, and we expect that by the end of the year, it should come down from 18 to about 12 or 13%. And next year, we expect it to go into single digits. When the economy is stable and inflation is coming down, it ensures that the erosion, the rate of erosion of the income in our pocket slows down. And so that is also a positive, you know, slowing down the erosion of your pay packet is a positive. And one of the most significant things that happened, and I want to thank the organized labor for it, is that we need during the year, and we agree on the increment, the wage, base pay, and minimum wage the year before. And so we're able to include it in the budget. You know, now we go after this at the end of the year, and first, this is why we start running the budget. And so now we're supposed to agree on what the wage package should be before we send the budget to Parliament. And so it is put into the appropriations bill. And so any review of the wage package must go with an amendment of the appropriations bill. That means Parliament will have to agree to do that amendment. And so that is one of the significant things that have happened. But we have new days coming up. I'm told it's in Wa, the national parade is in Wa this year, and we're looking forward to joining the people of Wa to solidarize with all workers across the world in the new day. But I believe that with the prospects that everybody is seeing, the World Bank, Economic Intelligence Unit, everybody is saying that from 2017, Ghana is going to see phenomenal growth. And I believe that with that phenomenal growth, workers are entitled to a fair share, you know, of the fruits of growth. And so, the future is bright, absolutely.
On that note, Your Excellency, President Mahama, we are most grateful to you, and we wish you a very good day.
Thank you very much.
And on behalf of all those who made it possible from A to Z, we say thank you very much. Radio BR of the Ghana Broadcasting Corporation, 93.5. And I'm yours truly, Anthony Good Jr.